You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Well, in terms of our relationship to the Maunga, and I might add that we don't have any issue with ownership over the Maunga. That's not at all what this is about. But the reality is that all of us in our own individual ways have a personal relationship with the Maunga, and in many cases it's a very deeply spiritual one. So from my own perspective, I've lived on the side of the Maunga for over 20 years. I care deeply about the environment and nature, and have watched with joy as I've seen the flourishing of the native bird life on the Maunga in recent years. And so when I heard about, at very short notice, that the authority was going to be cutting down 345 exotic trees from the Maunga, I just felt absolutely devastated, because I thought, well, where will all those beautiful native birds go for their food? Because they rely on the cherry trees, the banksia, and other flowering exotic trees for food, you know, year-round. And so, and that it really lies at the core of why all of us have come together, and there's hundreds of people now, and growing by the day. We're all deeply concerned about what will be the environmental impact of removing so many trees in such a short time. We support the authority's vision of cloaking the Maunga in native trees. That's not an issue for us, but to go about it in such a destructive way when it would take decades for those young native seedlings to grow to maturity, we just don't understand it. It just doesn't make sense.
Right, and so when you were talking about such short notice, I mean, there seems to be a lot of discussion around this topic, because it's my understanding that in about 2016, there was face-to-face consultation, quite in-depth consultation, and then after that 3 years, I believe when they started to do these works, they've created two dates for consultation with you guys, which I believe both have been turned down by you. Is this true?
No, not at all. So if you look at what sort of happened some years ago, that was, my understanding is it was consulting on planning at like a high level vision. Nobody in our community, and I might add we've had outreach from numerous people in other communities around Auckland, no one in our community was notified that we saw, otherwise we wouldn't be in this position, was consulted with, in that two-way communication sense of the word, about 345 healthy, mature, exotic trees being felled from the mountain in a five-week period.
Right, and it's my understanding that at the start of the year there was a community planting day, and there was about over 100 local residents who attended. Was that something that you attended as well?
I was aware of the planting day, and I would have attended but I had another commitment, which meant I was out of Auckland that weekend. But my understanding at that point, because I heard about plans to plant thousands of native trees and plants on the Maunga, and my initial response was, yay, what a great idea. But never in that communication was, oh, by the way, we're going to be chopping down all, 345 exotics.
So do you think that maybe the consultation that's been undertaken is really the consultation that has been prescribed under law? And so do you think that maybe there's a larger issue here that isn't really to do with the Te Puna Maunga Authority not consulting well, but consulting as they are prescribed to by law?
No, there's always choices in how one goes about things. And certainly in my experience, it depends how you define consultation. I take that as being a two-way communication process, not a telling. And in my experience, and, hundreds of people around the community, none of us feel that we've been consulted with. We weren't even informed, much less consulted with, until the very last minute. And then when we tried to contact the authority to ask for a public meeting, to just have our questions answered. We weren't asking for a negotiation. We just wanted to know why on earth they were doing it this way. We were just stonewalled at every step of the way. So here we've ended up in a position of now we've got a community group, the vast majority of whom have never done anything more radical than sign a petition or walk in a protest march. Now we have a community group occupying the mountain round the clock.
Yes, so I'm still confused here, but so you guys try to get in contact with the Te Puna Maunga Authority, but then So is it incorrect that they have tried to organise consultation with you and you have rejected it? If you are wanting to also talk to them, so that you're saying that they have not put forward two dates to consult with you.
Okay, so how they're positioning it is not the full truth. What the truth of the matter is, just in a nutshell, because this has involved over 40 emails and many phone calls with council officers as well as the authority, what the truth of the matter is that it became evident, to me over the last 3 weeks, is they didn't actually want to meet with us at all and answer our questions, and so tried very hard to manipulate the situation to back us into a corner to say that, we rejected, their advances for a meeting, whereas actually the opposite applies. And without getting into all the back and forth detail, we ended up in a position last Thursday where I had gone back to them and said, there's lots of toing and froing, but I'd gone back to them and said, we still want to meet with you. We have a bit of an impasse, basically, that you won't meet unless we come off the mountain. We don't want to come off the mountain if you're wanting contractors to come in to set up tree felling equipment. But look, the fact we're still on the mountain doesn't mean we can't still meet. We'd love to chat. And then it went silent from their end. We had a date set up for Saturday where I had Justice Rodney Hampton, who's a QC. He was set up to facilitate a public meeting with the authority on Saturday. The authority had said that date was fine. They had said that was a great choice of facilitator. And then on Friday afternoon, the day before that meeting, I get a call from a journalist saying, what do you think about the hui? I was like, what hui? So they didn't even let us know that they were, given all the toing and froing, you would have thought they kind of would have at least let us know. So we...
Hang on, sorry, I'm confused by what you mean there, because you're saying that you guys had agreed on a facilitator, you guys had agreed on a consultation date, and then you're saying that they...
Came out of the blue.
But you said that they've already agreed to it. You guys had both agreed to meet, so I'm not sure what the conflict is here in terms of a hui being different to a face-to-face meeting. Is there a difference?
It's quite a different thing. So we thought we had a meeting with them on Saturday afternoon, because the authority had said to us that it was up to us to organise the meeting. So that's what we'd been trying to do with them. So we had a facilitator that they agreed with, neutral third party, because obviously feelings are running hot, so we didn't want it to be,
Totally.
Very fair. We had a place and a date and a provisional time, and then just out of the blue, they say, well, we're holding a hui. I don't know if you saw their media release about the hui, but it had like 1,100 words in the media release. 61 of those words were about the hui, and the remaining 1,040 were smearing us. So we consulted with Māori people to make sure that we were being culturally appropriate in deciding not to go to the hui. I might add that the hui is something that the authority is holding, anyone can go. It's not specifically between our group and theirs. It's open to anyone.
Shouldn't it be for everyone?
Yes, exactly. But what I'm saying is we feel that given our experience in dealing with the authority to date, and given that they just like tried to manipulate us into a corner at every time behind the scenes, we feel that the hui, and given what was in the hui media release, which was basically just smearing us all over the place, we feel that they're setting up a trap for us. And I feel that we really need to step back in our engagement with the authority, and I think now is the time to actually look at how can we meet with them in a constructive way that's facilitated or mediated by an independent third party, whereby we can get out of this impasse situation that we're currently in. Because I know the authority doesn't want us occupying the mountain, and we don't want to be either, but we think in the time of a climate emergency, why on earth would you chop down 345 healthy exotic trees when it's going to take decades? And actually most of the things, they talk about 13,000 plantings, but we've analysed what they're planting. The vast majority, like over 90% of those, are small things. There's very few tall trees among those plantings, and those would take decades to grow.
Yes.
So we're saying, why not just let's step back, let's have a process that's got integrity, and actually look at an appropriate way forward, because we support what the authority is trying to do. We just don't want it done in such an environmentally destructive manner.
So, yeah, and this is the next point I do want to talk about is to put a Māori authority have got a resource consent to remove these trees, and that would have been independently reviewed by a number of ecologists, and it has support has been expressed by a number of ecologists, including and arborists, such as a tree council. So I'm wondering if... What is your science versus their science? How if they're saying that the long-term benefits are going to outweigh the short-term benefits, how can you disagree with that, especially once it's been given consent and gone through the legal process under the Resource Management Act?
Okay, so I would make two core points in that. One is just around arborist and expert opinion and so on. That one's been a really interesting one because, you know, my understanding is the, you know, arborists and experts are kind of either regally contract to the council, Auckland Council or the authority, or in their employ. Because we've actually been contacted by numerous people from those kind of industries, horticulturalists, arborists, etc. And I would say, or certainly in terms of the ones I'm aware of, without exception, they are totally with us and deeply concerned about the proposed approach, but no one will speak out because the Auckland Council and the authority are big employers and contractors of their type of services, so they feel kind of like they can't, you know, they can't speak out. In terms of the Tree Council, we've been contacted by a woman who was the president of the Tree Council for a number of years during the 90s, and she's deeply concerned about why the Tree Council is speaking out in the manner that it is. And I would say, don't you find it unusual that the Tree Council, which is an organisation that's there to advocate for trees, and particularly urban trees, is speaking out so strongly, removing not only 345 trees on Mount Albert, but thousands of trees off all of Auckland's volcanic cones in a time of climate emergency when we need trees more than ever before?
Well, I do find it interesting, but I think that's the point.
Hang on, but there's another thing. You find it weird that the Tree Council spokesperson keeps accusing us of cultural insensitivity? Since when has a tree organisation had the mandate to be talking about, I guess, cultural issues that go to the core of who New Zealand society is? I find it very, very strange.
Well, I mean, there's two things I want to raise with that. I believe that where they're coming from is that they seem to see that the long-term benefits are going to outweigh the short-term benefits. The second point I want to raise is that from my understanding, and a large part of this process as well, and removing trees is danger, but not just danger to human health, but danger to the archaeological significance of Owairaka, the nature of the roots, which are ruining the integrity of the terraces and the kumara pits and the like, and so the replacement planting, the shrubs and the trees are being, from my understanding, carefully planted so that there are certain types of trees being planted near these things that have shallower roots so they don't go into the walls of the kumara pits. And yep. Also, I know you've raised issues about things like lizards and things like that. Well, lizards don't actually live in trees. They live in shrubs. They live in leafy piles. And so the Te Puna Māunga Authority, from my point of view, creating a multi-leveled canopy and environment that isn't just ryegrass, which from my understanding is actively opposes native regeneration, and the same with pine trees. So it seems that they're creating an entire environment that can hold a greater level of ecology and biodiversity that isn't just seen in trees, and then also the longer-term effects and benefits of those trees in excess of what is being removed today.
Okay, so look, you've raised a number of issues. So what say I just talk about them individually. Yep. So in terms of the archaeological side of things, two points I would make is not all of the places where the exotic trees are, you know, archaeologically significant. So some of them are on heavily, you know, ground that's been so heavily modified there's nothing archaeological there. But more to the point, we've had significant outreach from residents of other communities where this has happened on their, you know, on volcanic cones in their backyard. And the people at Mangere are telling us that, and they've shown us videos as well, and I'm happy to share those with you, but the authority came and they took out all the, you know, mature exotic trees there, and so now there's no more porks calling at night, there's very little bird life on the mountain. The plantings, there's just patches of weed-sprayed grass with native little native plants sitting in pots dead on top of the grass. There's been no care or attention because they've taken the big trees out now that there's lots of erosion on archaeological sites. And someone at one of the other maunga where this has happened said that you can see middens now just being washed out of the hillside because there's no protective cover from the trees. So that's my response to the archaeological side. In terms of long versus short term, so in the natural, if you look at how things happen in the forest, you know, in like in a natural environment, and as you can see this happening on Mount Albert as well, is that the older trees form a protective canopy for the younger trees, and so they provide them with shelter as they grow to maturity, and then in time, you know, the older trees have lived their lives or they just get outgrown by the younger trees. And you can see that happening all over the mountain where the exotic trees have got like lots of native, the young native seedlings coming up underneath them already. The council, city council's website has a brochure on succession, good succession planting practices. And that very brochure says that, you know, most native seedlings don't do well in the open, that they need, you know, protective cover. So what we're saying is, why on earth would you remove 345 healthy mature trees that could provide a protective canopy cover for those young native seedlings while they grow to maturity? And in doing so, provide ongoing food source and habitats and homes for birds, for the insects that the birds eat, and all the other life forms that you can't even see. So it just doesn't make good sense at all to us. As I said, the people at Mangere and Pigeon Mountain have just said the environment looks barren and trashed. The birds have gone.
So this is just all in, I suppose, in preparation of their planting next year. So this is all just temporary effects until the following year, and I believe that they need the wet season so that the roots can get good amounts of water to plant and sustain themselves while in these areas. The other part I want to raise about
can I just make a point there? Two things about the plantings. One is the vast majority of plantings on Mount Albert, because we've analysed them, are low-growing small things. The tall trees will take 70 or 100 years to reach maturity. So, you know, again, it's not like it's a short turnaround thing where suddenly they plant and voila, there's a whole lot of fluffy green trees with happy birds in. It's going to take, you know, 50 plus years for things to come back to how they were. And what we say is it's so unnecessary. They could leave the exotic trees there to perform a protective canopy cover. The bird life still has food and homes while the native seedlings are growing up. So everything and everyone wins.
So what is your overall goal and aim for the maunga right now?
What this is all about for us is protecting those trees from being needlessly felled, because we feel that it will harm the bird life and the wildlife and everything and the environment. Remember, this isn't a time of climate change. And we're also concerned that it's not only happening on Mount Albert, it's happening all over Auckland. So you're going to see thousands and thousands of perfectly healthy trees that are doing a great job in a time of climate emergency being felled. And so we're very aware that how things play out on Mount Albert will affect, you know, will have a big effect on other places where this is going to happen. What we feel we've got to with the authority is an impasse situation, and I just think, you know, it's a shame that it's come to this, because, you know, the authority has a great opportunity to actually bring all of Auckland's communities, you know, everyone along with them in a way that could be a really positive and constructive approach, rather than a negative and destructive one. So that's what we would like to see. We would love the opportunity to speak with them in a way that was mediated by an independent third party that was approached with respect and integrity to find a way forward where the authority achieves its goals and we support those long-term goals, but in a way that's constructive.
When it comes to the Maunga, and obviously Ngā Mana Whenua of Tamaki Makaurau, and they are, in this case, exercising their autonomy over their own resources, do you feel as though this warrants, or your views warrant, what you're witnessing is pretty much a return of Māori land to Māori and the ability of Māori to exert their own autonomy over their own land, and you are seem to be actively opposing this? And as Tangata Tiriti, a person who is here by right of the Treaty of Waitangi, do you not think that perhaps you are actively going against the Treaty of Waitangi and other documents, for example, the Redress Act, which gave ownership back to Ngā Mana Whenua?
Yeah, look, I'm not, I don't want to get deeply into treaty-related debates other than to say I'm not alone in having had people say to me, you know, words, to put it crudely, it's their backyard, they can do what they want. And the reality is that that's a very simplistic view, because it's not like private property. It's not like someone has a piece of private property and it's theirs to do with pretty much what they want. It's a far more complex and nuanced setup than that. And that's demonstrated by the fact that there's co-governance between, like if you look at how the Te Puna Maunga Authority is set up, it's actually got iwi members, but it's also got elected council representatives, Auckland Council representatives. So there's a co-governance model. And it's a very, very nuanced thing. And we sought the advice of Chris Finlayson, who's the former government minister who was responsible for treaty negotiations. And I can send you his advice, but basically the conclusion was that it's very nuanced, that this was set up for the benefit of Māori and all other Aucklanders, but it's not about it's not about our group. I must make it very clear that our group has no issue with ownership or anything like that. We have no issue with the treaty or treaty settlements. Our concern is environmental, and in life sometimes you see things that you know are just wrong and you need to call them out, and this is one of them. And we feel very strongly about it. And again, particularly in a time of climate emergency, why would you be doing something that is going to remove thousands of healthy trees that are sequestering carbon from a city that is losing urban trees left, right and centre? I just don't get that.
So this is one thing I do want to raise with you, and it's part of the worldview that we probably share as Pākehā versus Te Ao Māori. And I don't think you can say that you can separate the treaty and what you guys are doing on O Wairaka, because we are Tangata Tiriti. We are here by right of the Treaty of Waitangi. So when it comes to... Hang on, I've lost my train of thought once again. But
it's a very nuanced thing.
But the ideology that you're sharing is that you have a single environmental concern.
Yeah.
The management of the Maunga is an intricate history. It has a geological, volcanic, Maori, European histories. If you're just looking at it from one point of view, the environmental point of view, you are automatically negating or putting a preference over all the other histories. And this has been exerted under the Reserves Act, 1977 Reserves Act. This has applied a monocultural framework to the management of the Maunga. Each Maunga, if they weren't a local purpose reserve, had a management plan, and they were assigned a principal purpose. Each of those principal purposes were not allowed to be acted against. In O Wairaka's case, it was a scenic reserve, which aimed to create a semi-rural atmosphere, the protection of existing vegetation and livestock, informal recreation, including car access and ryegrass, which was mainly planted to reflect the sort of rolling hillsides of Europe. And so part of the well, these became colonized spaces. Urban environment became colonized spaces, but the gardens became colonized spaces. These maunga became colonized spaces. And things like the livestock compacting, ruining the integrity of the archaeological significance. Do you not think that perhaps a wider approach, a worldview which is greater than ours, is at play here, that is beyond just the environmental impact of what the short-term environmental impact of what is happening here, and perhaps a plan to decolonize these spaces, provide for Māori, as is stated and guaranteed in the Treaty of Waitangi, and provide for the archaeological significance, the geological significance, maintain the amenity for all, access for all, because we're very lucky that we're all allowed access to these maunga still. And they are in the process, under their new ownership, of reclaiming these spaces that reflects their histories. For example, O Wairaka, do you know where that name comes from?
Totally. And look, I'm not... The reason why we're focusing on the environment, look, there's a whole lot of issues around this, for example, spiritual and cultural connections that Māori and Pākehā, well, Māori and non-Māori alike have with the mountains. There's a whole lot of issues around the side of it. But what has been the common thread in this group coming together has been an environmental one. That's what's been the rallying call for us. Of course, there's a whole lot of other issues around it, but that's what's been the focal call. In terms of all the minutiae of treaty settlements, and there's so many layers, as you know, it's incredibly complex. What I suggest would be a good idea is for BFM to talk to somebody like Chris Finlayson, who was there on the ground when this was all set up, in terms of the intent of it all. I mean, I'm not going to wade into that debate, other than to say that my understanding was that it was to be for the benefit of, ultimately for the benefit of the iwi of Auckland, and all Aucklanders, all other Aucklanders. But I think that's really a discussion you need to have with someone like Chris Finlayson.
But I'm wondering how you can say that these plans are not for the benefit of Auckland and iwi if this is what is proposed.
So
if you're only focusing on a short-term environmental impacts, and there are other stakes at play, and you're giving precedence to the prioritization or putting these above the other ones, you're automatically oppressing those other sides, oppressing those histories, the Māori histories associated with this, the decolonization process.
Well, as I said, we don't object to, we support the long-term goals. It's that the process, I'll give you an example. Like, our focus is environmental, but of course, people who have been involved in this movement, and I might add, it's not just Pākehā, we're getting Māori, increasing numbers of Māori coming and talking to us about this and saying that they too are concerned. And I guess what it comes down to is everybody, no matter who you are, what your race or culture is, everybody has a right to have a spiritual connection to wherever they want it to be connected to or have it to. So we've had members of our group who have come together, for an environmental shared purpose, but we've had people in tears at the thought of perfectly beautiful, healthy trees that their grandparents planted are going to be ripped out. So in other words, they're feeling that their cultures aren't being respected and their spirituality. And so that's why I'm saying it's a very complex thing. We're focused on the environmental side, but of course what's bubbling up around it is shared history, shared cultures. We totally support the fact that, Māori ownership, but it is a co-governance model. And my understanding, it is not for, it's a co-governance model, which means it's a more of a shared model. It's not as simple as private property. But what we would dearly love, I mean, we see it as an opportunity for, this has been played by the authority as a race issue, and that's so not what we're about. But I do see it as an opportunity for Māori and non-Māori to form a positive coming together. That's not to say that anyone should, that Pākehā should be controlling it or anything like that. But I just see that, you know, at the end of the day, we all have to live together side by side in Auckland and New Zealand. And I don't think it's healthy in any society, no matter who they are, where it's not okay to call out things that that one feels is wrong, where it's not okay to ask questions. We know what happens in society when people start self-censoring because they're scared of being positioned as something. Like, we know what happens in societies where you've got, you know, division and groups against each other. Like, I totally understand the need to put right the wrongs of the past. I totally get that. But I just question the process that's being followed at the moment and how that's really going to help Māori or non-Māori coexist together going forward, and how more important, and just as importantly, it's going to help our environment here in Auckland when we're losing so many urban trees as it is, in a time of the council has declared a climate emergency. As I said, it just does not make sense.
So do you feel there's a bit of favouritism occurring here?
Favoritism. What do you mean by that?
Well, favoritism. Do you feel as though the plan that is in place favours Māori above Pākehā, and that's what you're talking about, the we need to live side by side and plan together. Do you feel in this case, Ngā Mana Whenua o Tamaki Makaurau are being favoured above other Pākehā living here in Auckland?
No, I wouldn't put it like that at all. What I would say is that my understanding, and again, you need to speak to someone like Chris Finlayson, but based on what I've been told, my understanding was that it was to be more of a partnership with a subtle shift of power. But look, I'm not here to talk about that. I don't think, you know, it's about favouritism. I think it's about ultimately what's doing what's right. And I don't make any apology. I totally acknowledge the need to put right the wrongs of the past. I totally acknowledge, it's Māori ownership, but it is in a co-governance model, and the word co-governance means that there's a shared approach. And so I make no apologies, and our group makes no apologies for calling out unnecessary environmental destruction. You know, that's what lies at the core of it. In a time of climate emergency, why would you be taking out thousands of perfectly healthy trees that have a wonderful role to play in helping in this time of climate emergency? It just doesn't make sense. It's going to take many decades for those young native seedlings to grow up. So, you know, you're going to have a 50, 70-year gap to even catch up to where we are now. It doesn't make sense.
All right. I think if we keep going, we might just go in circles. So we'll stop here. But thank you very much, Anna, for taking the time to have a chat with me.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.